absent for quite a while, but here I am. This talk is really a combination progress report and a kind of apology for the life I've been leading for the last couple of decades, and has elements of a farewell address to, since I'm officially retiring in May, although I hope to be around in an unofficial capacity for some time longer. Let me begin by giving a quick summary of what I consider to be the mainstream of economics today, and I'll try to summarize it by. Try to summarize it by five characteristics. Speaking, you can think of the paradigm approach of economics as starting with a bunch of individuals, each of whom is rational in the sense that they have a well-defined preference order, and they make the most of their opportunities. Given this preference order, their opportunities in general involve what other households are doing, what other agents are doing. There's a fundamental distinction between households and firms. Households are the ultimate driving force of the entire economic system. Firms are special in that they maximize profits. The whole system comes to an equilibrium in which everybody cannot do any better than he is doing at the moment. And finally, there's a distinction. I mean, all of this represents an analysis of how the economic system is operating. There's an entirely separate body of doctrine called welfare economics, which indicates how it is. Operate. I will have the occasion to question all of these assumptions, not in the sense of discarding them, but in the sense of generalizing them and indicating that there are lots of situations where they're not the best kind of assumptions to make. Okay, let me start with human capital theory. In Gary Becker's Nobel address, he indicated that there was very, very considerable resistance to human capital theory, and you possibly can trace this to some kind of subversion of the third of the items on the list. The distinction between the household and the firm begins to break down once you take human capital theory seriously, because a lot of what's happening in households is actually the production of human capital. So in that sense, a firm itself is a kind, a household itself is a kind of little firm. And just to carry the analogy further, consumer goods would be inputs to this particular production. And you might foolishly conclude that the household's indifference map, which looks like this in terms of a pair of consumer goods, is actually the same as a firm's isoquant map, which looks like this. In terms of inputs. So there's a real problem involved there. In fact, it's really quite subversive of a number of these categories. Something like utility function becomes endogenous, in some sense or other, the entire bottom of economic theory has fallen out. We don't know where to start from. In other words, this you've got a typical list of things which is given from outside the economic system, which the main body of data would be the preferences of the individual agents in that system. Once that drops out, who knows? Well, you can still say, look, I think human capital has some significance, but maybe it's just a minor blip in the overall scheme of things. I mean, here's a household which invests in human capital. Here's another household which ignores the whole thing and just maximizes its utility, whatever that means. Typically, you give it some kind of hidden hedonistic sense, maximizing its pleasure or minimizing its pain. How do I know that the second type of traditional household really doesn't swamp the first type of household, and so that I really do not have to revise things very much? Well, the answer to that is really a second quiver, a second arrow of my quiver, and that is that here's a the capital investor, and here's B, which we'll just call the hedonist. And think of time going by and what happens to these two typical types of households as this occurs. Well, in the fullness of time, household A, other things being equal, is going to acquire more wealth than household B. A will have a higher savings rate, A will be more industrious, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, as I said, in the fullness of time, you will find a shift of wealth from A to B. And the net result of this would be that we may assume that A is the type of household that dominates in the long run. Well, this kind of argument is called the natural selection argument, and anybody who's thought of it really feels the power of that argument, but it's a wild type of argument. And one of the things I've been trying to do over these many years has been to sort of tame it. And to try to put it in a context where it makes sense, because this natural selection argument has been is really so powerful and so untamed that it's been used for all kinds of strange arguments. Nonetheless, one wants to think about these things and begin to take things like human capital investment seriously. Okay, I should say that what I'm going to do here is give sort of a once-over lightly of all of the kinds of ideas that I've had. I'm not quite sure how it'll go over. I really don't know. I do not have a formal model in the sense that one usually thinks of having a model. There is, however, a technical apparatus which I won't be able to talk about for the most part, and I'm not trying to tell you everything I know. It would just sound like gibberish if I really did. But at least within the time when it's available. So let me then begin by talking about people's mental outlook on the real world. Here's the real world, which you can think of as being made of people and institutions, events, and so forth and so on. And we have certain information about the real world, but in general, that information is quite often distorted. In other words, if this is the real world or a part of it, what we see is only one little bit of the full truth about this. For example, I mean, I know what Alan Greenspan looks like, and I know his position in the scheme of things, but I don't know what he's going to do about income, interest rates, that sort of thing. So this is, and of course, this is true for anything. You know, I have an acquaintance, even one I know very well. I know something about this individual, I know something about his characteristics, what he looks like, and so forth, but there's a lot that I do not know about this individual. That even applies to oneself. You don't know, and you discover surprising things as time goes by. So what you have is what might be called a perspectival view. This represents the full truth about something, and what you know is just a little piece of it. You have a certain perspective. Somebody else may have a different perspective. Somebody else may have still a third perspective. Now, the idea of a perspective is it's a very popular term in thought nowadays, postmodernism and so forth and so on. But from the point of view of an economist, it really isn't too much different from the kind of position espoused by the Austrian school and Hayek, for example. That is to say, knowledge itself is distributed quite unevenly in a whole bunch of different individuals, so it doesn't make sense to talk about society itself as having a knowledge, a technology or something. So it's a case of Hayek on the one hand meeting Nietzsche on the other hand. Okay, now, the real world itself is in space and time, and it's organized by causality. What I mean by like causality is essentially the concept of a dynamical system. That is to say, we have a set of possible states, and we have a law of development, which tells me that if I'm in a particular state at time t, let's say s of t, then the state I'll be in at time t plus 1, s t plus 1, is simply l of s of t. So this particular point maps to this, this particular point maps to this, that maps to that. The trouble is, in general, we do not know the law of development. that's a part of the thing we don't know. We may know some things. For example, I may suppose I represent X, like the sorts of things I know about some particular entity in the real world. And here's what X is at time t. If I go to X at time t plus 1, I do not find any stable relationship between these two, because there are other things, let's say yt, which I do not know or I cannot observe, which also causally influence the change over here. So you can refer to these things as being hidden variables. And in general, there are lots of hidden variables, as indicated by the fact. In other words, I look at a person's external appearance. That gives me little clue as to, for example, where that person is going to locate in the next 5 minutes. There are certain hidden variables involving mental states and so forth, states of the brain, which would help me, but they're not available. Hidden variables on the one hand from ignored variables on the other. That is to say, here's my particular bias. There are some variables which I can't see at all, even if I wanted to. They're the hidden variables. There are other variables which I could see, but I choose to ignore. And each particular profession typically approaches the world with its own set of variables which it chooses to pay attention to and other variables which it ignores. Economists, for example, typically will ignore institutional type variables, which I'll get to later on. Yes, question.
So apart from these hidden variables, you think of your capital L as a deterministic relation?
Well, the issue of determinism turns out really to be not a very important issue. In other words, you can think of two ways. Well, the world is basically indeterministic, meaning no matter how deeply I delve into something, I still wouldn't be able to fully predict the future. Or you can think of the world as being basically deterministic, but there are some variables that are so deeply hidden that I cannot get to. It comes to the same thing in either case. So I don't really think that there's any deep issue involved in the question of determinism. It's easier to think in terms of determinism when you're giving an exposition. Is that a partial answer to your question?
I don't know. Physics seems to have got a different view on that.
Well, actually, there are deterministic versions of quantum mechanics, and I'm not going to go into that. We can talk about that later if you want. Okay, so I was about to say, economists typically ignore institutional variables, whereas sociologists lock them up. That's their stock in trade. That's one reason why an economist like Ronald Coase, for example, his article seems so strange compared to the ordinary type of article, because Ronald Coase does pay very, very strict attention to institutions. There are a lot of people who call themselves institutional economists. Most of them really don't know any economics, but Ronald Coase is an exception. He's somebody who pays attention to the kinds of variables that most economists moving along. All right. We don't know, we have these hidden variables, which are not there, but we'd like to know something about these hidden variables in order to make causal predictions, if nothing else. And that leads to the concept of probability. The way we represent straight belief over these hidden variables would be a probability. And And there's a whole axiomatic literature which indicates why the way that we assign, the way that we conceptualize degrees of belief and uncertainty should be the same as what people believe. You know, why should we be added in some sense or other? Which I'll associate that with people like Ramsey or Fanetti. And also to that, I'll just take that for granted. In other words, I'll take for granted that the way of trying to assess one's uncertainty is by probabilities which obey the standard rules of probability calculus. Okay, now, an important distinction is that between universalism and particularism. Universals. Most words in the English language are universals. You can think of, roughly speaking, all common nouns, just about all verbs, just about all adjectives, and just about all adverbs refer to universals. They represent types. The way you recognize a universal is by asking the question, can this thing apply to more than one object, and can it be negated? You know, so red is a universal, because you can have more than one object being red, and you could have other objects being non-red. So that's it. On the other hand, particulars, of course, refer to individual entities like this desk, you, me, et cetera, et cetera. This room, the economic system, they're all particulars. And that turns out to be quite important from many points of view. First of all, causality refers to universals. If I have a set of possible states over here, these states must be universals. The basic reason being that a causal implication supports a counterfactual. You say, okay, I had this particular match, I struck it and it lit, but if this match were wet, then it wouldn't have lit. So I'm talking about something which didn't happen. Well, the only way of making sense of that kind of concept is say, if something happened, which it didn't happen, then something else would happen, is to think of these in terms of generalities. What you're saying is you have a possible state consisting of a dry match plus a lighter, and that leads to a lit match over here, and you have another possible state consisting of a wet match and a lighter, and that consists of just a wet match without the light. So there's that's a fundamental, fundamentally important consideration involving causality. And the next thing to look at is the sorts of things that probability applies to. Okay, the basic, you will recognize this sort of thing from these names as associated with the Bayesian approach, so-called subjective probability. I'm not quite sure that's a good name. But one of the tenets of the Bayesian approach is that probabilities apply to propositions. In other words, here's a proposition statement, pi. And the pi represents the degree of belief in the truth of this particular proposition. It lies between 0 and 1, of course. 1 representing absolute certainty, that it's true, and 0 representing absolute certainty, that it's false. This is contrary to what is called the frequency theory of probability, which in effect associates probabilities with some kind of universals. Okay, now, let me just very, very quickly indicate what's going on over here. My own reflection, my own feeling, is that if you want to have a picture of what probability is, you should think of probability itself as a kind of perspective on the world. I mean, here's a case that the world has a causal structure which we're only partially aware of. A probability that you assign to various things is a reflection what you think this causal structure will produce as far as this proposition being true or false from your particular point of view, your in terms of your history and the status that you have right now. Okay, and probability itself, for example, the concept of independence of the probability that you assign to propositions itself should be a reflection of causal independence. certain state of affairs, here's another state of affairs. If these two things are causally independent, then you should probably let them assign to the proposition that this and this should be the prime of these two propositions. Let me very quickly talk about this. The simplest kind of proposition you can think of is something of the form A is an X. Okay? In other words, here's a certain individual, a certain particular, and you say this particular individual has this particular property, is of this particular form. Let's just take that. First of all, this little X over here is part of a range of possible values that X could have. So we could say instead of X, I'll write an X sub I, and you have X1, X2, Xn. That's your set of capital X of possible values. The simplest kind of situation there is where you have just X, Xi, and not Xi. This is A is an X, and A is not an X. This particular individual is a citizen of the United States or not a citizen of the United States. Or you could have a number of possible countries, A is a citizen of country one, and country two, and so forth and so on. Or you can say, the population of the world at a given time is equal to zero, is equal to one, is equal to two, is equal to three, and so forth and so on. You've got a set of possible propositions there, one and only one of which was true. Okay, so what's happening is you're taking this this particular property over here, you're considering all the possible values it could have, and you're embedding this particular proposition in a set of positive propositions of the form A is a X1, A is a X2, etc. A is a Xn, and the probabilities that you assign to these things must be such that they have an exclusive and exhaustive range of possibilities. They must add up to one. That's one of the basic rules of probability. Let's go a step further. Let's talk not about one individual, but about the number of possible individuals. I'll put a J over there. So I have the probability that AJ is an XI. I could refer to individual number one is a national of this country or that country. Individual number two is a national of this country, that country, and another. There are certain conditions under which the probability, this would be J, the probability that I assign to these propositions is independent of J. And if that's true, it's a kind of stationarity property over there. In other words, I could apply this particular system of propositions. I apply it to this particular entity, I get a certain probability. I apply this other entity, I get a certain probability. If those probabilities are taken to be independent of the XJ, in other words, not affected by the XJ, then we have what you might call a general statement. I'm trying to approach the concept of objective probability. I'm trying to see how the concept of that fits into this overall framework over here, because at first glance, it looks like the concept of probability that we talked about over here is not adequate to deal with probability as it appears in the sciences, let's say in genetics or in or in physics or in things like that. But it turns out that indeed you can represent that, and the way you represent that is by saying there are certain aspects of this particular entity A, which are inessential to will send as a result of this movement. For example, I mean, the typical case would be coin tosses. If you have a fair coin toss, AJ may represent the J coin toss, and if this is supposed to be a fair coin, there's a kind of stationarity effect. You say the particular coin that is an XI, let's say it's either heads or tails, would be independent of the particular coin that's tossed.
Well,
we'll go a step further and talk about things like this. For any eddy, probability that A has property XI, given that A has property K, let's say, is independent of the eddy. That would be a case, in other words, you're identifying A by the property YK, you're saying, you're taking a look at all of the entities that are property YK, there's a certain probability that that entity also has property XI. Under these conditions, you're really talking about a relationship between this XI and this YK, and the individual itself has disappeared in this process. We're getting closer to the concept of a probabilistic representation of causality. Because causality, again, is a relationship between general, it's a relationship among properties. And the final step in that direction would be something like this. The probability that A at point T plus 1 has the property XI, given that A at time t has the property yk, is independent of A and independent of t. So that would be essentially a probabilistic representation of a causal law. We'll say that something is in state yk, then with a certain probability at the next time it is in state xi. So, I mean, the point I'm trying to make is that all of this can be encompassed in the notion of assigning probabilities to propositions. You don't have to say that there's a separate quantum probability which assigns probabilities to entities like this and which represents the kind of probability that's used in science. Okay, well, let me go on and talk about statistics and its foundations. There's the history of statistics is a rather strange one, and let's first of all find some of the implications of the Bayesian hypothesis. Let's carry that step forward. And again, what we're saying is this: if you're uncertain about something, you represent that by assigning probabilities to propositions. Consider the statistical technique of testing a hypothesis. Okay, typically what you do is this: you've got a system of possible hypotheses, H1 through HN. Let's assume they're exclusive and perhaps exhaustive. You assign probabilities, PH1 to PHN. You observe certain evidence, let's say E is evidence. And as a result of this evidence, you come out with a posterior distribution. Prior distribution is the posterior distribution. All of this represents standard inference procedures. Why should one go further and test the hypothesis? To test the hypothesis means to have some kind of procedure where you throw out one or more of these hypotheses, maybe all of them except one. Why do that? In principle, you don't have to do that. You could just readjust your probabilities over here. In general, evidence typically does not completely refute a hypothesis. basic reasons for doing that is, however, one which represents the limitations of the human mind. You can't think and can't keep in the air all possible hypotheses. What you've got to do is to limit yourself, because your capacity for thinking about these things is limited. So you're over here and you say, look, there's just too many, life just gets too complicated if I have to think about all H1 through HN. What I will do is have some kind of procedure by which I will throw out some of these. But you have to keep in mind that this represents really a distortion of standard probabilistic inference. What you're saying is, look, this is pretty low, so I will just set that to zero. In effect, I will say that HN isn't there anymore, and I'll just concentrate my attention on the others. And in fact, the extreme cases where arbitrarily perhaps set all these things to zero, that are not really zero, and assume from now on that H1 is the true hypothesis, I just work from there. Okay, well, that's testing. The important thing, what I'm trying to get at is this. If you're a consistent Bayesian, you don't really have to test. But to be a consistent Bayesian, you have to assume that the human mind has infinite information processing capacity, which it does not have. So that's one thing. Now, consider the estimation. Well, estimation does what? It essentially takes a point on the real line and says, okay, here's my estimate of this particular this particular random variable. We don't really have to do that. Again, what I could do is have a prior distribution. I observe evidence that gives me a posterior distribution. I might have something like this, representing the density of that posterior distribution. But to estimate is to do something further. It is to replace this distribution, which you can say, from my point of view, is all that I'm justified in doing, with a different distribution, which is absolutely concentrated on one single point. You're saying, in effect, I know for sure what that evidence is. That is to say, to estimate something and to use that estimate as if it were correct is to distort the kind of evidence that's available to you. And the point I'm making is that you really have to do this. You can't avoid doing this simply because, in general, life gets too complicated. If you try to carry out a complete probability distribution over any number of random variables, it's simply beyond our capacity to do that. You've got to reduce the complication somehow or other, and you do that by choosing hypotheses, by estimating, and so forth and so on. Well, what's involved in this? In order to have a correct theory of what you should do over here, what you need is some sort of rule to tell you when it's okay to substitute a certain hypothesis for a more complicated hypothesis. You're deliberately simplifying your view of the world. You're doing it at a cost, however. So in effect, what you're doing is taking a look at alternative ways of representing your knowledge. You're trading off a cost of inaccuracy for a cost of complexity. That is to say, when you take this hypothesis and replace it by a single point over there, you're substituting a simpler hypothesis that you know to be less accurate in terms of your the information that's available to you, but one that is certainly simpler, and working with that. For example, let's suppose I'm doing a study of demography. Well, I don't know exactly what the population of the United States is, but it's approximately 260 million. Well, for many purposes, it might be perfectly accurate to act as the population of the United States were exactly 260 million. What I'm doing is I'm making a point estimate over here. I am saying, look, maybe it's off by 5 million in either direction, but it doesn't really matter. For my purposes, I just need ballpark 5 estimates. That 260 million is perfectly adequate. and taking account of the entire distribution would really be superfluous. So that would be a typical example, and we always do that, of course. We always round off numbers. Okay, well, this is what I've been calling this particular structure in which you minimize the sum total of these costs. This is what I call the post-Bayesian approach. And it's a kind of decision theory. Decision theory, in effect, is a doctrine that developed with Wall in the 1940s, and in effect says you should treat statistical inference as a kind of action. In other words, here's if I were choosing an industrial plan, I take a look at various alternative hypotheses about the way the world is. For example, what my demand would be next month. I choose different possible production levels, and I say, given this demand level, this production level, here's my level of profits. What I will do is choose that particular production level, which, let's say, maximizes the expected profit. That would be a very, very simple case of decision in the face of uncertainty. What Wall did was extend this concept to what you might call cognitive decisions. Cognitive decision means what you do is you rearrange your mental furniture in such a way that life gets simpler. I mean, Wald didn't put it in this term. Wald does not have this particular concept of cost of inaccuracy versus complexity. In fact, he doesn't have the concept of complexity cost at all, as far as I can see. Wald would ask the question, look, if you're going to make a point estimate of something, there's a loss associated with making a point estimate theta hat when the true value of theta is this particular value. So there's a loss, there's a probability distribution, and so forth, and what you do is you choose theta hat to minimize this. Okay, that would be a typical situation. What Wald doesn't ask is, why should I point estimate in the first place? Because Wald was not a Bayesian. Wald was a follower of the Neyman Pearson approach. Therefore, in effect, what you have to do, you have to estimate. You have to do something because the concept of probability distribution over theta is considered to be illegitimate. He didn't say, look, I don't have the alternative of leaving a posterior distribution there. What I have to do is to have to point estimate. And how shall I choose this particular point estimate? Okay, but ironically, as it turned out, that the work of Wald was a major factor in the revival of the Bayesian approach, because he found out that the only sensible way of making decisions of this particular select was, in effect, to assume that there was some kind of prior distribution on this thing, so-called Bayesian decisions. Okay, now, let me talk about a critique of statistics, and in particular of econometrics as it's practiced today. It turns out, from the point of view of this approach, that current statistical practice is really rather defective. let me just ask, are people in general aware of the fact that the standard approach to econometrics these days leads to a systematic bias against simple hypotheses? Well, it does, and let me just give a few minutes exposition for this. We'll take the case of testing, let's say testing hypothesis H0 versus H1, and let's suppose that H0 is nested inside H1. So H0 says, let's say that this is the true value of a certain parameter theta. H1 says that, says that the true value is some particular set of parameters in case of that particular of Okay, well, typically what you do is you form the likelihood ratio. Here's your reference, E. You form the, let's say, the probability of E on H naught, probability of E on H1. You form that particular ratio, and when this hits a certain critical level, let's say if it's, let's say there's a certain number of lambda, such that if this is less than lambda, you would accept H naught, which you can think of as the null hypothesis. H naught is the simple one. And if this particular ratio is greater than lambda, let's see, am I saying this right?
I think
no, I'm saying it backwards. If this is below lambda, then you would reject H naught. And if it's above lambda, then you would accept H naught. All right, there's some trouble with this. For simplicity, let's suppose that H naught is a simple hypothesis involving no free parameters, and H1 is a composite hypothesis with lots of parameters. Well, there's no problem evaluating this, but how do you evaluate this? You've got all kinds of nuisance parameters in there. In other words, we really should write this as H1 with a beta over here, and this particular probability is going to be influenced by beta. What's the typical process by which this is done? Well, the answer is, in Neyman Pearson theory, what you do is take the maximum of this. In other words, you replace this particular thing by, numerator is okay, there's no problem there. You replace this by the maximum of the theta, probability of E given each one theta. Why? Well, because on Neyman Pearson theory, which is standard approach over here, it's illegitimate to assume there's a prior distribution over theta, which you have to average out. In other words, if you were allowed to do that, if you put a prior distribution on theta, then this particular probability over here, given H1, would be the probability of E given H1 theta multiplied by the probability of theta given H1 integrate to theta. This would be the proper way of calculating that. But instead of taking an average, you take a maximum. Okay. But that's cheating. That means you look at the evidence and then select your best card. So in effect, what's happening is the H1 can cheat, whereas the H0 can cheat, because that is that's based. And that, in effect, puts a downward bias on this particular ratio. Okay, and this particular thing also carries over when H0 has a number of parameters, but H1 has more than user for you. In other words, in effect, you're systematically biasing your result toward that parameter which has the larger number of degrees of freedom, which of course is the more complicated. That's why I say there's a systematic bias against simple hypotheses. Okay, so you've got this, and there are lots of other problems with this. What we actually have is some combination of R.A. Fisher and the name of Pearson, sort of taking the best points of each, so to speak. There are severe problems with significance tests. There's also severe problems even with such a thing as confidence intervals. We can easily find cases where the standard theory of confidence intervals is nonsensical results. Okay, well, so in effect, what's to replace this? I mean, it's easy to criticize something, but what you want to do is get something better. You do want to allow things like estimation and testing, the reason being life is too complicated. But these kinds of procedures typically are good. One is it's a form of evaluation. You have to evaluate what you gain or lose by doing these various procedures, and that leads to this sort of thing. What I'm saying is that statistics would no longer be an autonomous discipline, but somehow or other it has to incorporate evaluations in its procedures. By the way, the value is something. well, that's economics has something to say about values. And one could even sort of try to psychoanalyze statistics in the following way. You know, I started to have a rather strange history. Decision theory reached an apex around 1950 with the appearance of Wolf's book, but then it tailed off. And nowadays, I think very few statisticians would identify decision theory as the central core of its discipline. The major reason, it seems to me, is that if you're going to use decision theory, one of your legs is missing. That is to say, statisticians are experts at the probabilistic side of it, but they don't really know or particularly care about where the valuation side of it comes. I mean, typically in decision procedures, you arbitrarily assume all that kind of quadratic loss of some sort or other and follow from there. What you want to do, however, is to have a more comprehensive theory in which you have both values and probabilities endogenous to your investigation. Okay, well, that leads me to my next topic, which is institutions. I realize that I'm rushing through this at my full breakneck pace, but I mean, what I'd like to come out with, I'm not sure how much of this is appearing, is that I have an essentially harmonious and unified way of approaching all of these problems, and they fit into each other, and it's quite comprehensive in scope looking at all of these things. Okay, let me talk about institutions. What I want to do now is to go to the economic side of this problem and ask where the values come from. So I'll talk about institutions now, and then I'll talk about capital theory later on. Okay. Suppose I have two agents, A and B. Let's suppose that the behavior of B affects A's utility. And this fact is known to A. And A can do something about it. A can exert influence over B. Under these conditions, we may expect that A and B will exert influence over B. Okay, you'll notice, by the way, that this is tied up with the standard concept of externality, because this over here is precisely the definition. There's an externality from B to A. Because what B does, A is not indifferent to. Okay, so under these conditions, A can exert influence over B, and you can think of various kinds of influence, some benign, some malign. If, for example, the existence of B is actually decreasing A's utility, it's quite possible that A will try to drive out B or kill B or something of that sort, if the cost of that is not sufficiently great. Or A could coerce B in some manner or other. Or finally, if this turns out not to be feasible or too costly, A can bargain with B. Say, look, I will ask B to change behavior in a way which is more favorable to me. In exchange, however, I will do something with B. Maybe hand over a certain amount of money or perform some service in return, so forth and so on. So this is the you can think of this as the origin of contractualism. Contractualism has to occur between people of roughly equal power, because if A has much more power than B, the simplest kind of result would be that A simply coerces B to do what he wants. Typically, a contractual behavior is something that occurs between near equals, and you can extend this, of course, to several kinds of individuals. And when this particular kind of contractual behavior becomes habitual, you've got the beginnings of an institution. Now, what is an institution? An institution, first of all, is a set of rules. You say, okay, in this particular situation, this happens. The institution that I'm thinking of, kind of paradise, is the law. The law, in effect, says, here's a certain situation that's occurred under these conditions. Here is the law that applies, and that is to be carried out. You could even think of the judicial system as being divided into two parts. The trial is the one that determines exactly what the facts are, and then the judge and maybe the appellate process determines what the rule of law is applied to that case. An institution then is a set of rules, and typically these are rules which are based on a set of values, which you can think of as the ideology of the institution. Well, there are, you can think of two opposing types of views. One of them says, way back when, institutions themselves were deliberately created. Social contract theory is an example of this. You have some kind of way back in prehistory, a group of people got together, formed a social contract, decided that it was time to stop killing each other and cooperate more, and that was the origin of the state. The other kind of approach, largely associated with Hayek, although it really originates with Hume, is to say that institutions grow naturally, and you can actually put this in some kind of natural selection framework, which is pretty much where Hayek ends up. His 1988 book, which says, in effect, look, there are various possible institutions over here, various possible institutional arrangements. What you have is some societies will choose this institutional arrangement, some will choose that one. The ones that choose an institutional arrangement which is actually beneficial to people in general will tend to flourish relative to those societies which don't. So you've got a kind of selection among institutions, which is really quite parallel to the kind of selection among families of type A and type B, which I talked about before. What's involved here? I mean, the kinds of variables that one tends to look at in this framework would be rather different than the ordinary type of variable. You have, first of all, means of communication turn out to be very important here. A has to get together with B somehow and communicate desires to B. You can expect that institutions will become stronger the easier it is for people to communicate with each other, so that a national state is strengthened by subsidizing the internal means of transportation within that particular structure. You also have what you might call the conversion of means to ends. Where, let's say, an institution is formed, some kind of common organization, and one's first approach to this is a pragmatic one. You say, okay, here the United States was just formed, let's say we've had our constitutional convention. I don't have any particular loyalty to the United States. My loyalty, if anything, is to my own state. I think it might be admissible going to war with each other. So for purely pragmatic reasons, I take this particular institution as being a good thing. But as time goes by, one, in effect, forgets the original reasons for doing something, and the means, which the pragmatic approach, becomes an end in itself, and national loyalty develops, and so forth. And there are okay. somewhat for institutions. Now let me go on to capitalism. We started with human capital at the very beginning of this process, and the conclusion that I derive from thinking about this is that capital theory should be put into the center of economic theory. And capital theory obviously applies to capital goods. It has long absorbed land. The value of land is a reflection of the stream of quasar rents of land in the future. And the fact that land is not producible is really a relatively modern limit in this particular thing. So applying the capital theory to human resources really completes the picture and shows that in some sense of our concept of capital is universal. Okay, so let me just begin by talking about, let's say, a standard problem control theory. Suppose my problem is to maximize. X is the state, that's your state variable at any given time, T is time, A is an act which you can perform at time T, it itself might be constrained to a certain set which depends on T and X, and so there's your problem. Okay, now the standard approach to this is to form what is called a Hamiltonian. And this P over here is can be thought of as a shadow voice. In fact, I can give an interpretation of what this P is in terms of some of these other variables. But P is a shadow voice. It represents really what happens over there. In other words, suppose that I take a particular time T. Make the rate of change of these prices equal to the function. So this thing over here is h of x of t. That's this thing over here. Partial of this with respect to h. Okay, those are the standard rules. And let me just mention a few. Here. First of all, this is a disguised form of the present value. Because delta H, delta X is what you might call the quasi rent, the marginal productivity of the state X at any given time. Put this in integrated form, it says that the price of time t equals the integral from 0 to wherever your upper horizon is. It doesn't have to be infinity, it could be t. that's what you get over there. What happens to discount rates? Well, discount rates basically built in. This is a discount price.
In actual terms.
The structure over here, this particular Hamiltonian, has a uncanny resemblance to national economy. If you want, you can think of this term over here as corresponding to consumption. And this term is corresponding to investment. In fact, this thing over here is the rate of change of x. That's p times x dot. That really is a kind of investment.
So what you do, optimal policy, is this calculating the income of Hamiltonian the right way, choosing your action so as to maximize this at any one time, and
now, there is, however, one little problem over here. There's no, in a typical society, there's no central director that is maximizing it. In a centrally planned society, possibly this might make more sense, but not in a decentralized society. There's another thing, too. What is the x? I represent the x. X is the state variable. You can think of it as being a vector x and x. And what do the x represent? Well, in general control theory, they can represent anything. However, there's one particular kind of interpretation which makes sense in an economic context, which does not necessarily make sense in a general context. And that's when the exponent of xn represents stocks. That would be a stock interpretation. Now, for certain kinds of problems, it makes sense to talk about a stock interpretation. For other types of problems, it's rather strange. For example, if I had a picture of the solar system, the typical variables would be things like velocities and positions, neither of which are stocks. Okay. It wouldn't make much sense to talk about those things as stocks. And indeed, you have real problems involved in that. Just take something like a ball rolling across the floor. Well, location is part of the state of some entity, and certainly determines whether how much something is worth. That's an important consideration over there. When a ball rolls across the floor, it's in a whole bunch of different locations. We'd have to think of each of these things as being a different stock. So immediately, if you try a stock interpretation, you'd have to go to an infinite number of possible stocks. Nonetheless, it's worth doing. Because once you've got a stock interpretation, this sort of thing is more or less forced upon you when you're dealing, as I said, not with a single process which you're controlling from outside, but with a social process in which the individuals are coming together with some kind of comeback and coming to a conclusion. The basic reason is that you cannot exchange positions, you cannot exchange momentum from one person to another, but you can exchange stocks. Okay. That's the basic idea. So if I have a interpretation in terms of stocks, then I can talk about other things which otherwise wouldn't make any sense. For example, px dot makes sense no matter what the x is. So here's a change in the state of a certain system. Here's the shadow price associated with that. That makes perfectly good sense. P times x, however, makes sense only if x is a stock or a set of stocks. It doesn't make sense to talk about the shadow price of a velocity multiplied by the velocity. I don't give you much. But the shadow price of a stock multiplied by a stock, that's a kind of wealth term. And under those conditions, and wealth is something that is exchanged from one individual to another, and so that makes sense. So if you've got a stock interpretation, you can make
make P times X meaningful, which you kind of do otherwise. Just to give you another example, economists, of course, use production functions all the time. You will rarely find the concept of a production function in books on engineering. The reason being that engineers typically will think in terms of other types of state variables. A mechanical engineer will think of the particular state of the machine, where the piston is, and so on and so on, or might think in terms of pressure or temperature, things of those sorts. Those are all non-stock variables. Those are easy to understand in terms of engineering, but it wouldn't make any sense to multiply those things by prices. What you've got to do is take the engineering concepts and translate them into stock terms. You've got a stock of inputs being translated into a stock of outputs. Okay, well, what you can do now is the following. You can say, look, suppose that I have a bunch of separate individuals. Each one of them has a optimization problem with this particular system. Let's say U1, X1, T. I put ones to indicate I'm talking about the first individual. And so forth and so on, each subject to its own little dynamics. X1 dot equals G of X1, Z, A1, something like that. Okay, and suppose that these individuals have also the option of trading with each other. Okay, or to put it in another way, you've got X, let's say at any one time, this would be the stocks of resources on society at any time. And this particular stock of resources has to be distributed among these individuals in some way or another. So X1T, you can think of this as a vector, and all of these things are vectors, X1T, X2T, plus XNT. There are M agents in that particular system. Okay, so you have the choice of how much of this particular stock you want to hold at any one time. So you've got trading among the various stocks. In other words, you've got a pile of resources, which is divided into n separate piles. Each of the individuals is using that particular pile of resources in his own fairly way. This pile of resources is going to have net productions and consumptions, which you can then sell to other people. In other words, you're going to change this particular value over here. Okay, when you work through the results, you find that in effect, under perfect competition, what you're doing is maximizing a weighted sum of these utilities. In other words, here's number one, here's number two, and so forth and so on. There exist lambdas, lambda 1, lambda 2, and so on, such that the society as a whole acts as if it's maximizing that particular weighted sum of the lambdas, where in fact you can even give an interpretation of what the lambdas are. The lambdas are proportional to 1 over the marginal utility of money. In other words, what you have over here, you've got you choose one of your commodities as the means of exchange. And there's a certain amount of utility that agent number one will be willing to trade off for, let's say, one standard dollar, however you're arranging over here. And that particular trade-off, delta M, delta U1, if you want to call it that, would be 1 over lambda 1. So lambda 1 would be the reciprocal of the marginal utility of money. This particular result in a static context is attributed to the Ishii. In other words, you can say competitive equilibrium not only gives you a creative optimum, that's a standard theorem of welfare economics, but with some extra but fairly fairly light extra conditions, what it does is maximize a weighted average, or a weighted sum, I should say. Utilities, the weights being proportional to these lenders. So in some sense or other, the entire economy is acting as if it were maximizing a single utility function, which is a weighted sum. Now what I wanted to do, maybe I shouldn't go through this last step here, but what I wanted to do is to ask, is there anything we can say about a long-term trend to what's happening over here? Because maybe I can give you an analogy. Richard Posner has one of the standard theories of the evolution of the law. So you want to know, is there anything that determines how legal evolution proceeds? Is it optimizing anything in some sense or other? And Posner's theory is that, in effect, the law evolves so as to maximize the wealth of society. He doesn't really have a detailed theory of how this works, but it seems reasonable that according to Posner, at least, that is what the law does. It evolves in such a way. In other words, the court decisions are made in such a way that maximizes the overall sum. Let's suppose A is suing B. Okay? So the question is, shall I decide from A or I decide from B? You have a general rule evolving over here, and according to Posner, what would happen is if you decide from A, that establishes a general rule for the cases of that sort. And the general rule that typically the courts will come to is that rule which will lead to the greatest overall level of the law. I can elaborate this further. What I was going to do was to give a further interpretation of this book, but I think I will put Rallo ahead of it, so to speak, and just say I do believe that there is some kind of long-term evolution. I'll just mention that what it seems to be is some kind of movement to it, a kind of utilitarian arrangement, but I won't try to justify. Okay, well, thank you. Well, let's put it this way. The Neyman-Pearson has no choice but to maximize, because because they do not admit the kind of operations that would require you to average. This actually is an interesting point. I should say that there is a way of correcting this. There is a so-called big VIC would be one way of correcting this. In other words, what you do is you take a look at these two things, maximum over theta of theta versus averaging the integral theta averaged over theta, theta given h1, theta. You take the ratio of those two. There is a way of making a correction. But that's really not the point. Let's suppose you remove this particular bias. You're still in trouble because you really have not answered the question. You see, this bias has nothing to do with complexity. The real reason for doing any kind of statistical inference whatsoever is to reduce the burden of complexity. So this does nothing. See, if you don't make this correction, and for example, you try to let's say you have 1,000 different variables in a regression. Okay, so you start with a few of them, and you test this thing, and you find there's some others that are significant. You test that, and find others that are significant. Ultimately, the number of variables, independent variables, can grow without limit. If you got this kind of thing over here, precisely because you've got a bias against simple hypotheses, even if essentially, let's say 995 of those other variables are irrelevant, they're going to be in there. They'll get in there because of this. The Schwartz criterion corrects this, but it doesn't go far enough. What you really want to ask the question is the following. I mean, here I have 1,000 variables. It's ridiculous to try to put 1,000 variables in this equation. What I want to do is to find a way of selecting a small number, which are the crucial variables, the essential variables, and throwing the rest out, even if the rest have some influence. That is something which present-day statistics has no way of handling. The only way of handling that is to put some kind of evaluation on what you mean by negligibly small influence. In other words, relatively small inaccuracy for us. So what I'm doing is I'm approximating the causal system, which might be extremely complicated. I'm essentially taking something which is close to that in model space, so to speak. I'm saying this is much, much simpler. I know it's inaccurate, but I think that the simplification is worthwhile. And that is something which present-day statistics doesn't do or can't do unless it explicitly incorporates values into this framework. So what I ultimately would like to do is essentially take values. In other words, what we have here is, you have the concept of objective versus subjective probability. You also have the concept of objective versus subjective value. I mean, in economics, you deal with only subjective values. Here are your individual atoms, they're the agents of your society. Each one has a certain utility function. Those are subjective in some sense or other. They refer only to the welfare of the individual. Is there some concept of objective value? Well, I try to get at that. Obviously, I didn't succeed very well. Try to get at that with the concept of an institution as being a set of rules which are governed by a system of values, which I also call ideology. But ideology is not necessarily a bad thing. And the question is, where do these values come from? I mean, people talk about values. You know, I argue with you. You don't talk about these things as if the values are just your personal emotion. Say, I think this is important, or this is just, or something like that. It's just, I'm not really saying I this. It's a matter of personal taste. What I'm saying is, this is what I think is right, and this is what you should also think is right. That's the whole purpose of dialogue over here. But the question is there something that corresponds to objective value?